It's a small group here, but for the sake of the recording and those listening from the other side of the world, I'm extremely pleased to welcome Professor Helmandeek, who teaches at the University of Chicago, who's going to talk about, and I don't have it written in front of me, text mining on ancient Greek texts. Mining classical Greek literature, even.
Yes, and on the screen you'll see the name of Richard Wehling as well, who's a classics BA from my university, and who's now doing computer science as a master's degree. So he's the brain of this operation when it comes to merging what happens at Chicago on textual databases, text mining, and applying that to the classical field. Because all by myself, I am very enthusiastic, but not necessarily capable of carrying out what I would like to do. So today I'm going to talk about one of my current projects, which I thought would carry over better to a non-classicist audience. But I think it's still of interest to classicists as well. I do hope it's certainly of interest to me. The question is, we've seen lately text mining techniques used in all kinds of humanities fields. It's starting to happen. It's starting to become available. And I was wondering what we could do with Greek literature in this respect to essentially answer the question, can computers teach us Greek? Well, of course, we've been actually learning Greek from computers for a long time. We've been doing word searches, consulting automatically created concordances, location data for a long time, and so it's not as if learning from computer applications to classical texts is something new. But there is a difference there in approach. If we talk about some long-standing questions in the field, whether those are questions that are well advised to stay away from if you want to have a job, or if you want to not be immediately sent to an insane asylum, or not, right? It's really those are some of the big questions in the field. Author attribution. Is it possible to know anything about male versus female language in classical Greek and Latin? What can we know about the relative chronology of certain works, such as the Platonic corpus? Big question there. Homeric corpus, same idea. What can we say about narrator versus character text in epic? That's been looked at to some extent, right? But also in other texts. So possible questions that you can think of that have actually been looked at in the past are the chronology of early Greek epic, famous book by Richard Yanko, who used to be at University College London, if I'm not mistaken. Lysias, a speech writer, and there are a bunch of speeches associated with him, but they are kind of variable in how certain people are that these speeches are actually by Lysias or just attributed to Lysias. Character versus narrator, I mentioned that certain adjectives in Homer are associated with only direct speech by characters and not Ornstein has worked on that, for instance. The seventh letter is one of those stay away from it topics. It's a letter by Plato or not by Plato, recounting his experiences on Sicily with a philosopher king slash tyrant. And it would be so great if it were real Plato, because then we have a really nice story and we really want that. If it's not Plato, that really takes away a lot of the value. But it's a short text, so what can you really say? How did we do this? How do we do this as classicists? We read. We may sit in our baths as we do that. We browse concordance. We repeat till we have a notion of something that we think is worth checking out. We do a word search. If you saw my actual normal computer screen, you would see Diogenes sitting in that dock to be clicked on. So I could do a search in Diogenes. I could check concordance results. That would be my targeted search after I have my aha moment at step two, right? And after my targeted search, I can figure out that this was a nonsense notion, because actually what I thought I was seeing just browsing turns out to be completely nonsensical. And so I can write this out if there was really something there, right? Or I can return to step one and turn on the tap in the bath and get my OCT text out. So this was before. Now, enter new technologies of data mining. Questionable that we can actually catch terrorists. Can we read Greek with this? This is the question. Procedure. Do not sit in the bath while doing this. Do not read. Do not browse the concordance. And do not repeat. Do not decide on possible criteria in advance. Do click submit on your search form. We'll see the search form. And see what happens. Decide if those findings are actually of any interest. This is, so here comes the big issue, right? If not, return to step three. Five, give talk regardless. Here I am. Actually, there will be some content. I promise there will be content that you may find amusing. Okay, so where is that submit button that I mentioned? Well, here I am stealing from a guided tour to Philomene. You'll be able to find this on the web. I'll give you the URL later. Philomene is a text mining extension to Philologic, a open source text retrieval and searching system by the Artful project. Philomene 2 is open source. This is installable under Mac OS X, just as long as you don't have an OS X server install, but just the regular OS X install, it's actually easy. If you have a server install, that makes it harder for some reason. But Philomene is what I'll be using. And here is that part of the first screen that you you see as you start using the system. And at the top, you see the submit button. There is the big button that I mentioned. Okay, so what actually happens? Well, this is not really important yet. You do see this little box that says random falsification. which means that if you think you've found something and you think that something might be significant, see what happens when you click random falsification and look at the difference between what the outcome is when you try to falsify your results. Algorithm, that's the really important one here. We will see a number of classification mining algorithms, and I'll just be using actually two in this talk, but you'll see a menu of different ones. And just to go on slightly, when you do this, you can compare entire documents or you can compare divs. I think the collected audience, parts of documents. You can say, okay, they should have a minimum length. You can say, okay, I want just the forms as they occur in the text, or the dictionary entry that they are related to, provided that you actually have that kind of information in the database that you're searching, of course. And bigrams, those are straight two-word sequences, and besides lemmas, you have bilemmas. You can decide to use all four. You can use straight up word counts or more frequency based kind of instances. Okay, moving on to the algorithms to show you. Here we have the next screen, and you see a number of possible algorithms available. These are really put together in part from Weka, which is open source, and from other sources. So you have a bunch of different methods here that you can use to query your database once you have loaded it. This is not a coincidence that it's sitting at multinomial naive Bayesian. What does that mean? It means that we're going to take documents or parts of documents and treat them as a bag of words. We're not worried about what exact sequence they come in. We're just worried about what words are in there and what words aren't. So it's a very, very rough and ready approach. What I'm also going to look at is vector space analysis. That's harder to get your head around, I think. All the data about occurrences of words are, you should really imagine as a vector in a new dimension, you should really say, okay, every single parameter is a new dimension, and your data about menin and aida and thea and all your other words in the database, add up all those pluses and minuses and ones and zeros and so on, and you end up with a vector in n-dimensional space for all those various data that you talk about, and you start comparing the vector that a document creates. Okay, this is probably grossly inaccurate, but this is the best I can do in human speak, I think. My math is worse. Okay, the Philomene tour that you can see on the web will show you how to use those forms. We'll say, okay, here is what is going on, and it gives you examples of how clicking one box versus another box will have radically different results. And then you get this red letter warning at slide 40, and you will understand we are not yet at slide 40, that to make effective use of machine learning, you must know your data, have a clear grasp of your problem, understand all these algorithms and parameters and features, and be sure to actually evaluate your results by running these things. Okay, so one of the things you can do is systematically run through different algorithms and different settings for all the things you can set on the form that you saw earlier. What I will do is I will do one little part and run through just a series of experiments where I change just one thing at a time to show you a little bit how that might work. So it's clearly not yet knowing my data or having a clearer grasp and understanding all these algorithms. I'm just going to camp out in one little area and show you what can happen when you do that. And well, that would be the evaluating your results, I suppose. So I will give you a few examples from applying this to Greek. And my first sort of extended example is about gender in Greek drama. Now, why gender in Greek drama? First of all, this is a really hard problem that people basically throw up their hands about, because if you want to talk about women's language in Greek, people say, well, you know, you have a few lines of Sappho here and there, you have, you know, maybe a handful of papyrus letters, but to actually do anything that is statistically significant, forget it. It's impossible to do. Why would that suddenly be different? Well, it's not necessarily different, but it does give you license, I'll say, to squeeze what we might out of the little data that we do have. What have people done in this area? Well, Shlomo Argamon and his colleague Moshe Kopel have looked at the authors in the British National Corpus and have come up with a series of parameters by which you can decide whether somebody is a male or a female author. Right? So you train your engine and you say, okay, these are the males and these are the females, and you hope that they can start being successful in classifying them as male versus female. And actually, this turns out to be pretty successful. Okay, so we have gender of authors, but we still have only those few lines of Sappho. So go to the next one. Identify gender of characters in Shakespeare. Okay, so here we have a male author, notice, a male author that we respect as a playwright. I think that's an important point, right? So we have a male author, but we're going to treat the characters in that author as texts by themselves. So we're going to look at Romeo, and we're calling all the texts that Romeo speaks male, and we're going to call all the texts that Juliet speaks female. Now, this could be Shakespeare being Shakespeare in one way and in another way in the two groups if you manage to sift them. However, there's an overlap between those two first corpora, the British National Corpus, generic novels, and Shakespearean drama. Even further, there's an overlap in the kinds of features that are associated with male versus female when you start looking at the gender of authors in French. This is work done at Artful. And the worst case scenario, you take a big database of drama and you have both different gendered authors and characters, so you have these male authors writing the text for male and female characters, and female authors writing for male and female, right? So you have these two binaries intersecting, and the nice thing is that you actually find constants between those different languages and drama characters versus actual authors, between what is, so you have parallels, constants of male versus female. So now, this is really nice for somebody in the hopeless situation of a classicist who will never have, you know, endless amounts of women's language showing up out of the sands that will add up to, you know, a serious corpus, right? Because now we can actually have a corpus. Here is Aristophanes in the Fogs, putting these words in the mouth of the playwright Euripides. Euripides very proud of the fact that he gave voice to women, slaves, masters, to the whole gamut of characters. And Aeschylus, grouchy over traditional Aeschylus, is not happy at all about that. Right? So we can say, well, there is some anxiety about this mimesis of these characters on the Greek stage. Okay, does that imply, it seems to imply that there was, that it was felt that there was an overlap between male and female in the real world and male and female on the stage, even if this was male playwrights, male actors, and everything else, right? So there, this kind of example you could look at and say, well, apparently it was felt that there were men and women represented on the stage. Another example of that is, of course, our favorite male chauvinist, Plato, who really does not want his charges in an ideal state to be exposed to this, to women who have all kinds of emotions, God forbid, and people who are not quite the men they should be, right? So it's not just women, it's also slaves or slavish types. So, so much for Aristophanes and Plato. Then finally, what is important for me as a linguist generally, why I like to look at dramatic language, which other people will argue is highly stylized, it's metrical, it's poetry, and all that. On the other hand, somebody like Aristotle will say, you know, this is really very close to the natural spoken language. So this is my sort of, you know, apology to the classicist for actually taking this seriously as evidence, or, you know, grasping at any evidence that you can get for this question. So what I'm going to do is look at those characters in drama for what evidence they give us, or question whether we can actually differentiate male and female speech. Okay, so here is Philomene again. What we're going to look at is 491 characters in plays of Aeschylus, Sophocles, Euripides, and Aristophanes. Those are the texts of the Perseus Project made available for anybody to play with. The characters are the characters in a particular play. So if Oedipus shows up five times, then we're looking at Oedipus in the OT as one character and Oedipus in the OC two males in the class. How does this work? I tried to get the most ugly Greek font to, you know, give you the code feel of this, right? So you have the encoding here with the speakers. Athena, Odysseus have a line or two there each, right? How does this show up when you're normally reading the text? You have that on the left there, Athena two lines, Odysseus a line, Athena a line, etc. Here, this is the text of Sophocles' Ajax. On the right-hand side, you have the character Athena from Sophocles' Ajax, with just those lines merged together into one file, right? So you get Egnon, Odysseus, Caipalai, Philax, Eben. That first line goes in the first line over there. What are the characteristics of my corpus? I have 345 males and 146 females. You can divide them into human and divine and animal. The animals include a dog that says, ow, ow, and that's it. So he falls out of the sample pretty quickly. 413 individuals and 77 choruses. So these characters we encoded as, for instance, a female divine individual, FDI, Athena, or a male human individual, Ajax, so that you can then start saying, okay, well, classify divine versus human, classify female versus male, but don't give me the choruses. Not interested in those. Or classify chorus versus individual, right? So you can play out those various parameters against each other. And for the rest, we have tragedy, comedy, and a little bit of satire play. Okay, here comes a first test. I filled out the form. The speeches should be not too short, but 250 is actually quite short if you're thinking about analysis in terms of author attribution or stylistic analysis, right? It's quite very small, these samples. The method, the algorithm used multinomial Bayes. Words dropped that occur under 5% in under 5% of the documents, which in this case are the text of Athena in the Ajax, and over 95%. We make sure that we take for any run as many males as females. Otherwise, a computer, if you have 90% male and 10% female, then its job is really done very fast, because you're going to say, okay, if I have to take a guess, I'll guess male. And you're going to be right 90% of the time, right? So what you need to do with these things is you balance your sample. I'm only looking at surface forms, and we're not going to worry about normalization. Okay, here is a result page. That over there, that sort of grayish tint, should be red, because what I asked for to get this into this slide is only the incorrect classifications. You see the results in that tiny little thing at the bottom. The classifications for the whole set, male and female, were 83% correct. At the side there, what you see is what are the males that are misclassified, choruses, Xerxes, Peleus, Cadmus, Orestes, Polymestor, Heracles, and women, Clytemnestra, Athena twice, 15 characters from Aristophanes, Tecmessa, and Kallini. So, what is immediately apparent is that Aristophanes is different from the rest, right? And choruses are a little odd as well. What I found interesting is shall we say, some strong women in this first run, Clytemnestra and Athena, showed up. Clytemnestra kills her husband, and Athena is a goddess with the powers that go with that. What features did the machine think were important? Well, at the top you have the features for men, at the bottom you have the features for women. The men have martial stuff like stratou there, meaning army, taichion, the walls. They also have, they have man and more army, and they have this autos word, self, but also just a pronoun. What do the women have? And they have that word all. Women, lots of family relations, children, husband, mother, father, etc. Woe is me, typical adjective, and more woes later on. The house comes up, a possessive pronoun my and a demonstrative pronoun these. Why do I have these in red, that all with the men pass, and emos entade, and these yellow words as well? Those are things that show up in those other corpora that I talked about earlier, the English and French literature database, as features that are associated with this male-female divide as well. So men like quantifiers. You guys are all about numbers, and we are about pronouns. So now the audience knows that it's all men here. No. you see those yellow family terms there, right? That's an interesting characteristic. So here are some conclusions from that first run. Aristophanes' female characters, not all like females in tragedy. Choruses do not behave like the individuals, so we're going to take those out, and we're going to look further at what happens with Athena and Clytemnestra. Tecmessa is really strange. Tecmessa is your womanly woman, and so what she's doing there is an interesting question. Remember that we get these this sort of balanced run, so you never know quite what you're going to see next time. So I dropped Aristophanes, but I did want to mention that if you look at Aristophanes alone, he appears to differentiate men and women anyway. He just does not differentiate them in the same way as the tragic playwrights do. This is actually a problem for me, but good for the machine. You can see how this undermines this whole notion of we can extrapolate this to real world men and women if you have to start doing this by author. Anyway, we'll ignore this, and drop the choruses and drop Aristophanes and keep everything the same. What happens? We have Clytemnestra and Athena again, two old men in Euripides, and Orestes in Euripides. So this Orestes character is interesting. The old men seem to pop up as exceptional. Looking at the features, this was from the first experiment. Here's the second experiment. You see very similar notions showing up for the men. Again, army, city, wall, gate, enemy. Also this underlined there, legon, heko, legon, not together actually, legon, saying, marked as a masculine with a masculine ending, and Heko, I have come, wouldn't immediately strike anyone as, you know, typically male language. However, if you think about how, you know, Greek culture is supposed to work, the men are the movers and shakers who actually go somewhere and then come somewhere, and the women are supposed to just stay at home, so why would they say, I have come, which is a typical thing that people will say when they first get on stage, right? I have come from such and such, I've seen this terrible thing, or I've heard this, that there has been this terrible thing. The women, take one, take two, again, lots of these family names in yellow, personal pronouns in red, and in green you see these affective, dearest, woe is me, unfortunate, you know, love, you know, terrible things happen in tragedy, and this is what these women are expressing. Quick statistical overview. I mentioned random falsification earlier. You see that consistently you have close to the 70s when you actually do the experiment and ask the machine to distinguish male and female, and when you randomly assign categories that have no base in your data, you get a much lower accuracy in random falsification. This is what you want. That should be somewhere near 50% if you just throw the dice. Somewhere near 50% because it's a binary classification. So, conclusion from take two, that certain characters continue to stand out. There seem to be real effects there, and there are fewer misclassifications when you leave out comedy and choruses, but it doesn't actually boost the accuracy all that much. It's actually quite similar. One more go at this, using lemmas instead of surface forms. A first try at reducing the enormously complex morphology of Greek and trying to see if by reducing it to the dictionary forms, if we get better results or not. And this really is a toss-up. You could say, okay, we get thicker data because we have these lemmas that will actually show up more. And the word for man will not show up in four places but just in one because we've merge all the instances. On the other hand, you can also say, well, the feminine endings are going to disappear. The I and you versus he and she is another thing of being interactive or talking about others. Right? Those things disappear when you reduce to lemma. So it's an open question. And what happens? Well, the number of features reduce significantly, but you see that the number of features that I can actually use are quite similar. So you see in the surface forms from the take one that 95.87% of features are removed. And when you have the lemma, you only remove 86% of features on the basis of that threshold that I've put at 5%, right? So what do we get here? Still pretty much the same view, really. Men on top, women at the bottom there, army, stuff, priest, that pass, quantifier, and theos is new there. The women look very similar from what we've seen. for. Here are the classifications. In Euripides, lots of males missed out on, and among the women, we have three Athenas that are not recognized as women, which I thought was a really nice result in this discussion, right, that you can imagine, even if you don't know the discussion, sort of what is it about men and women and their language, and some people say, well, it's all hardwired, right, and other people say it's all about power. This would seem to point in a certain direction. And just to give you an example of, you know, what you can then do when you're, you know, when you've seen these classifications and have seen time and time again this Euripidean male show up as misclassified, and you've seen the feature sets associated with men and women. Here is poor Pelias speaking, and in yellow I have all these words that you see among females, and in red, one lonely Polin here, the city, that is a male-associated word, right? So he says, oh, marriage, marriage, who have destroyed this house and this city. So you see he is extremely, he's expressing his misfortune, right, and that calls upon precisely those words that you've seen in the female listings. Now how about Athena? Here she is. And Athena is in a very manly role here. She says, "Herald, give the signal," and I'm quoting from the translation on the Perseus website now. "Let the restrain the crowd. Let the piercing Tyrrhenian trumpet, filled with human breath, send forth its shrill blare to the people. For while this council hall is filling, it is good to be silent, and for my ordinance is to be learned by the whole city for everlasting time." So you see how Polin pass on there, the whole city, right? You have the army various times, right? So you see how she is appropriating a male role here, even if it's not quite as dense as this earlier one. For two lines, it was really dense, right? It's quite clear that Athena is doing that here. So here was one example of an exploration of texts, and the question of gender in drama, and how you can, you know, how you can tweak these settings a little bit while really using the same algorithm all the time. So here, to give you some further possibilities, what I should first say is that, you know, this bugbear of author attribution is really not what Philomena is designed for. But what you can do is do a vector space analysis and see what texts the system feels are the most closely associated with the particular text that you're looking at. But you have to be mindful then that most closely associated can very well be very much topic-driven, sort of content-driven, and not necessarily a stylistic measure of authorship, right? As you saw, right, those words that showed up in the drama text were very much, well, in part, were very much also content words. So what could you look at? You could classify authors against other individual authors or against the entire rest of the corpus. I mentioned that retrospace analysis. So here are some examples of searches. The Lysianic corpus, what are nearest neighbors in this corpus? We know about some speeches that they are considered authentic by the experts. What are the nearest neighbors of those speeches? And on the other hand, which speeches are given nearest neighbors that are not actually speeches by Lysias? What happens if you have Isocrates and Demosthenes fight it out under a Bayesian analysis like I did with the female versus male? What if you try and classify two speech writers? What kinds of things show up? And where does the analysis give up? And that, of course, is repeatable for any set of authors. Nearest neighbors in Homer, what interested me there is what books of Homer, when you do those div-level analyses, what books of Homer are associated with each other? Is it true that people's least favorite book of Homer, book 10, would show weaker association than others? What about Plato's letters? And what about if you take Platonic dialogues and classify it with a corpus that you call rhetoric? This is going to be confusing, so I'll take a quick look at that and I'll show you what I've done. Here you get a little bit of Libyan landscapes. While I get you the proper result, let's see. This is not going to take long, I promise. Plato and rhetoric, here we go. So the question is, what I've done is I've defined my corpus. Oh, I'm going to shove this in your direction so you can actually see this. Here we go. I've defined my corpus on the... we have a corpus 1 and a corpus 2 that I'm comparing. And they're both from the same database, Perseus Greek texts. One has an author defined, Plato, and the other has a genre defined, rhetoric. So those are the speech writers in the Perseus texts. And what I'm asking the machine to do by means of this vector space analysis is take Platonic dialogues and find their nearest neighbors in the rhetorical genre. Now, it's horrible to put the classicists in the room on the spot on what you would think would come out as the best example of rhetoric, but I think you could at least come up with the apology, which is actually Socrates' speech in defense of himself, right? And if you look at the highest scoring, Platonic dialogues for this, right? So what I'm looking at is, okay, I'm getting all these speeches from Demosthenes, etc., right? And what I was interested in seeing is, well, where are the highest scores? So we have a high score in the Apology, 0.78 there, whatever that means, right? It's a score over 0.7, and there was a total of 5 works that had a higher than 0.7 score. So we had the Apology, the Menexenus, which is a funeral oration, and Gorgias, which is a work about the power of rhetoric. Let's see, what was the 0.7? 7, here we go. So the Apology, Gorgias, Menexenus, Protagoras, also somebody who thinks highly of his own rhetorical skills, and the Symposium, where one speech after another is given. So I thought this was actually this is the problem with, you know, when you're doing something and you get a result that you like, right? It's a little bit like the sociological research, like news, right? And then they say men do, you know, X, and everybody says, well, I knew that already. But I think this is really interesting. I think it's interesting to see so much Demosthenes in here. Let me go back to how do I do this? Oh, I should play this again. Yes. So I can show you other of these examples. I thought this was particularly wacky because you're filling out one field of the form and you're saying Plato, and you're taking another field and you're just filling out the genre and letting it play out like that. But here are some examples. When it comes to the inscriptions that people work on here, what is possibly of interest is that one of the applications with the encyclopédie that is the big encyclopedia of Diderot and D'Alembert, which people have worked on at Chicago a long time, that has subject classifications, and the interesting thing is that sometimes those are actually in the original printed text, and sometimes they aren't, or data capture just didn't get them. And one of the interesting things that you can do with classification is trying to classify the unclassified, right? Or trying to classify anything on the basis of what's in there and see what happens with the ears and the renounces or something else. And my sort of thought about that was that it might be interesting if you have inscriptions lying around that actually have a very nice classification of their content. One of the things that you might do is take the unclassified documents from other collections and see how those map on to those other subject classifications. So that's yet another application. I think I should stop here because it's actually 5 o'clock already. At least on my machine it is. And I'll be happy to look at one or the other example. If we have connectivity here, I'll be able to pull things up, of course. But anyway, what I want to encourage you to do is play with this yourself. And I do want to point out that much of the work was done by Richard Wehling, and of course the whole infrastructure is the infrastructure of Artful, Mark Olson as the lead developer with Russ Horton on the Fielding project. So thank you for showing up on a September afternoon.
Thank you. That's that's extremely fascinating stuff. I could have sat through another hour of that quite happily.
I was shocked at how late it already was.
Yeah. Any questions?
I might have missed it at the beginning.
Oh.
You said that Philomene is either a server program to install or just a self-reliant client program.
You have to install a database, and then people can query it.
So it can wait in a certain format.
The corpus really is as a medium. Let me quickly exit. of the presentation and open I should open another window, but here we go. Oh wait, of course I'm not connected to the internet. Yes. Okay. What shall we do about that?
Let me see if I... Do you want to go online?
Could you? Yeah, that would be...
Yep.
Let's see, we have KCLCCH.
No.
Here? No? Wrong one?
No.
Still for
King's Wireless.
Okay. Oh, wait.
Cancel this one first.
So? Okay. Now... thinks it's okay, but of course it's not. Oh, there we go. The short answer is that Philologic will eat pretty much anything. So if you have TEI documents or just plain text, you can load it into Philologic. It will eat anything, including sort of weird South Asian to Greek to English and French. Or it has tons of databases in various places with either extensive markup or very light markup. And Philomene is an extension to Philologic where, you know, really it depends a little bit on what language you're in, how easy it's going to be to have particular capabilities. So for instance, I showed you that Surface versus Lemma thing. Well, it has built in software called TreeTagger, which will reduce English and French just fine. We have locally the beginnings of TreeTagger parameters for Greek to lemmatize Greek, but as Gabby probably saw and Nami's probably saw, it's not exactly foolproof as at this point. And so that kind of extra capability really depends. But the short answer is that let's see, going back to my presentation, very end, more Q. Go to this website at Google, our friends at Google, they're good for everything, here we go. Here we go. The code for Philomene now lives on Google Code, one of the next services that Google offers. And one of the things that you'll find there is that Philomene tour that I mentioned, but also the installation instructions on various flavors of macOS. That's basically OS X is what we're locally completely working with. It used to be sort of a mix of Linux and other things, but it's all OS X now.
And so you think this will only run on OS X?
No, it's really Linux. It's not an OS X.
Right.
It really runs on so, but the different flavors of mm-hmm. Unix are, you know, require a little mm-hmm. tweaking.
Right.
But yeah, it's not going to run on Windows. But if you have any flavor of Unix, there are people with other flavors of operating systems out there who are fine using it. Lots of Linux fans in France, apparently. I guess Mac is the But did this answer your question?
But anyway, what you
can look up is this page on filming generally and fiddle logic. You Chicago, you should get you there for the classical stuff. We've essentially parked it on an address for CSU Chicago.edu. So for my project, thanks to the availability of the Perseus Greek and Latin text under a Creative Commons license, we can take those XML texts and use them in other applications. So there's a we've made those texts available for searching under Philologic. And this is another application built into that. Some of you were at Peter Heslin's presentation on Diogenes last week. Diogenes has certain strengths. The Perseus home site has certain strengths. Philologic has certain strengths. If you're one of those people who has a weakness for concordances and for massive amounts of data quickly, then Philologic is really an immensely helpful tool. And I am one of those people with a weakness for concordances, so I need it. And I thankfully can get it.
Your gender results reminded me of an article from about 20 years ago by Carol Clover, in which I think she was studying Old Norse literature, and she claimed that the gender system that people actually conceptualized was very much like what you describe, in which a particularly valorous woman is in the same category as normal men, and feeble old men are like the bulk of women. And I mean, insisting that, you know, with what validity, I don't know, since I don't really know Old Norse, that this is really how they thought, rather than being as easy for us to accept the idea from your results that, well, okay, Athena isn't actually that much identical to other women for various reasons. Which suggests to me the idea of, a lot of people have done so far with text mining is to look for something very clear-cut like that. And maybe we should go ahead and look for something subtle. Because, in fact, the answer you get is more subtle than the initial question. It's not actually just giving you the biological answer, but something that's actually closer to the cultural answer.
I suppose that's precisely it, right? What is interesting to the humanist is not learning the gender of authors of the in the British National Corpus, or the gender of certain characters on the European stage. What is interesting is what features float to the surface that you hadn't considered yet as possibly marking, because it's so, you know, those frequencies, it's so hard to, you know, how do you really feel out that a definite article is, you know, just an inch, you know, more frequent, right? You really cannot get there by yourself for all these things, unless you have a preconceived notion that the definite article is going to tell you about gender, right? So it would be immensely difficult to actually reconstruct that. So the nice thing about this is that you get features offered, which you can then say are trivial when it's about you know, an adjective that in this form only occurs in the mouth of women. You know, okay, so fine, right? But then there are maybe things that are really much more interesting. So the features are what is really interesting, and yeah, the outliers, absolutely. So those are, I suppose those are really the two interesting things. If you get 100%, which was, you know, when I did that little sidebar on Aristophanes being perfectly, you know, perfectly differentiating, you know, between men and women. That's so disappointing, because you want one old woman or, you know, or some grouchy guy. You want them to be on the other side and then, you know, have something to look at, right? So all you're left with is looking at the features at that point, but clearly there's no standout character. And I mean, I'll confess that when I first wanted to do this, I was really hoping for Antigone to, you know, pop up. Never did. And then when I now think about Antigone's language, I suddenly realize that, of course, she talks a lot about family members. Mm-hmm. She talks a lot about dying. She talks a lot about... So, actually, she's very prototypically female. Mm-hmm. And if you had to, between Antigone and Ismene, to say which is which, well, Ismene says you have to follow the law, do what the city wants. But she is the, you know, the meek, womanly woman, right? If you first start out, and then you... Now I have to rethink that and sort of say, well, actually, maybe she's actually defending the status quo, and maybe she would pattern as a male more. But so Antigone just never popped up as one of the, you know, not classified as women. So that was, you know, that's one of these small disappointments in my life.
It strikes me that these features that you spotted are the most telling features. Are very, very genre bound to this. So I wouldn't be at all surprised there that Aristophanes doesn't fit with these features.
Right.
Because it's certainly the big features you've identified are much more about the topic and the role played by these characters than they are necessarily about their use of language. You know, do they use more adjectives than others or that sort of thing? If men talk about war and the city and the laws and things like this, and women talk about family and death.
Right.
Well, that's because, that's the sort of things that happen in tragedy. Medea, I know, just doesn't turn up as a masculine character, you know.
Exactly.
Those sorts of things. So these are characters who are, maybe, you know, women in tragedy tend to be transgressive. That's why they come across as, the most transgressive women, like Medea and in some interpretations, Antigone, are not unusual women from that point of view. And old men, when you bring an old man on stage in a tragedy, he's not a warrior. He doesn't come on from battle. He comes on to say some disaster's happened and his family are dying and that sort of thing. So it's not that they're more womanly. It's that they're having the same. It's to do with the role they're playing.
They have a passive role. Mm. What to me is fascinating and what needs further investigation is. Is this depressing reality that even when you look at 20th century corpora, you get very similar distributions, right? Not that, the 20th century guys talk about the war and the walls all the time, but right, you do get some of these very similar distributions.
Yes.
But I agree that it will be interesting to look more closely at the Aristophanes as well, and see what's going on there, and whether in function words you start seeing an overlap that you don't see in content words, maybe.
Right.
I think one way you could handle that is looking at those thresholds of the 5% and the 95%, and playing with that a little bit, because of course function words should be more frequent, and so if you take out those low frequency things, you would get closer to function words only, and seeing what happens there. So it would be interesting. That might be one way of going about this. cameras in the room, what I wanted to mention is that when I looked at those nearest neighbor analyses in Homer, is that without fail, nearest neighbors for books of the Iliad are books of the Iliad and books of the Odyssey, books of the Odyssey. It's, you know, another argument for that other... I don't remember who proposed this, but the authoress of the Odyssey. But we'll find our female author yet, right? We just couple it all together. But that's really startling that it's so. And again, you could say it's content, that is, you know, it's quite possible, but it's striking to me.
I think you could tag the speeches in the Odyssey as male and female, couldn't you?
Right, exactly.
But you get all of the catalogue of ships is all Helen, isn't it?
No, it's on Homer. It's on Narrator.
Yeah, it's
on
Narrator. You're talking about the when they stand on the wall.
Oh right, yeah, okay, yeah. That's separate. That's true. Okay.
Yeah. No, but that's definitely so. Martin Mueller has at Northwestern has actually tagged. That's not in the Perseus text, but in another set of texts. He's actually tagged Homer for speakers. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it would be the sentiment would be trivial to do the same kind of thing for characters in Homer. And some of Plato has been marked up. Some of Thucydides has been marked up, but done by different generations of people at Perseus. So there's some work there to be done to actually make those markups consistent. So because now when I go to when I go to this particular corpus, I get genre in here, and if I'm in this other corpus, the drama, I get gender in here. And that's basically a reflection of the fact that gender sits in the XML, and that produces a MySQL table, and that produces a form that can, with which you can query. So it's it really whatever kind of metadata you have in whatever text, you'll be able to use that in here. And
is that gender of author or?
Oh, this is going to be in this. This is the these are those drama characters.
Yeah.
So
okay.
Author, I can say I want female versus male, not Aristophanes, or I want female versus male,
okay.
Sophocles or Euripides or something like that. So, and I can for genre. So I do have to query the same database. So then I could put these different gender classifications here, and I can then say in genre, say, okay, don't bother me with the Sacchic plays, or do. So those are where I would use that. And so those div level things, those come standard in the form, and I don't use those for the characters. Yeah, that's basically how this how this works. I mean, the basic way is that you should really play with it for yourself.
What I love about this is the fact that you have to play with it, and you have to see what patterns come out, and then see what you can make with them. I mean, you you know, the software really has to give you your questions.
Exactly. It's a very early stage heuristic, right? Mm. And that's what I meant by the, you know, sitting in your bath and reading thing, right?
Yeah.
If you go to a concordance or to a search engine, you have to decide what you're going to search on.
Mm.
You can't say, find me something interesting.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And this is one way of, you know, the computer system throwing some tidbits in your direction that you might find interesting.
Yeah.
And whether they are actually interesting, it's not up to it, it's up to you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really a heuristic device that can just handle quantities of data so much better than you can. And so that's where, you know, that's the continuing thread.
Because it's often been part of the rhetoric of digital humanities that the computing serves the humanities. The humanities scholar has to make all the decisions, otherwise it's not good scholarship, in a sense. You can't let the computing define your questions for you.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think actually that's what makes it exciting, is when the computing allows you to ask questions you never thought of. You know, or just throws up things. You think, oh, there's a new tool. I'll just play with that and see what comes out of it.
And this is a mix, I suppose, because the kinds of things that we find interesting are there in the, they're there because we added them as metadata.
True.
Right. But it will throw out things that you may not expect because it is a sea of words. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But what is enlightening about these things is that, if you look at the Philomene tour, which I recommend, what you'll see, for instance, in these feature settings here, right, is you get these TF, IDF scores and the log of the TF, IDF score, and so on. And you get examples from their work in the LCPPD where, okay, so we check this box, and we get this set of nearest neighbors. And we check this box, and we get this set of nearest neighbors. And it's not that one box gives the right answers and one box gives the wrong answers. It gives a different set of answers that you can do with as you please. And you can, I think it's legit to do with it as you please, because it's the first step, because it's the heuristic, and it's not, well, let me see if the computer, you know, tells me that Greek adds up to 42.
Okay, well, I'm sure we could again carry on for another couple of hours. Still fascinating, but possibly we ought to stop and do that in a slightly less formal environment. So thanks again very much.
Thank you.